This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to part two of season three, episode 19 of Resolve Mysteries.
Woo!
If you're here for the first time, don't start on part two. That's just silly. Go back and listen to part one. But this is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show, Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Carlin.
I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
And what are we talking about in part two?
I am going to be talking about the unexplained death of Michael Franke.
Oh, and then I'm going to finish it up with a missing segment and the story of Oded Gordon.
All right.
All right, ladies, let's do it.
Here we go. Segment three, Michael Franke.
This is really segment seven for us today.
Oh, like segment 300. I mean, it's certainly hour eight and a half.
Segment 3000. Okay. It's an unexplained death.
Okay.
And it takes place February 1980. And we're starting the segment at the New Mexico State Penitentiary in Santa Fe because they are talking about the violent uprising that happened that year.
Oh, yeah. Spook.
Yeah. Stack says that by the time order was restored, 33 prisoners had died at the hands of fellow inmates.
Jeez.
New Mexico's scandal-plagued penal system was front-page news across America. So I had, like, heard of this before, but I really didn't know about it. So I really quickly inserted a little Wikipedia blurb because you kind of need to know mm-hmm. what started everything. So the New Mexico State Penitentiary riot, which took place on February 2nd and 3rd, 1980, at the Penitentiary of New Mexico, south of Santa Fe, was the most violent prison riot in U.S. history. Inmates took complete control of the prison and 12 officers were taken hostage.
Damn.
Several inmates were killed by other prisoners, with some being tortured and mutilated because they had previously acted as informants for prison authorities.
Oh my gosh, they're getting revenge on everyone.
Yep. Police regained control of PNM 36 hours after the riots had begun.
3 days is too long for a riot. Too long.
By then, 33 inmates had died and more than 200 were treated for injuries. None of the 12 officers taken hostage were killed, but seven suffered serious injuries caused by beatings and rapes. Yeah, so that's what that is.
Thanks for that.
They just, like, glossed over it.
You know, the New Mexico thing.
Yeah.
Nope, no big.
So, State Deputy Attorney General Michael Franke was brought in to investigate the riots and revamp the prison system. Stack says that Franke achieved dramatic results. His reforms gained national recognition. Stack says his reputation brought him a new challenge. In 1987, the governor of Oregon asked Franke to take over his state's troubled prison system. Oregon Senator Jim Hill says that Franke was the best appointment the governor made, and by all accounts, there were going to be some very good changes happening in corrections. He says, and I can tell you just how much of a shock it was when he was murdered.
Ooh.
So that's the start of the segue. Stack explains, quote, tragically, on January 17, 1989, Michael Franke's distinguished career came to an abrupt, violent end. He was found stabbed to death just outside of his office building in Salem, Oregon. Before he died, Michael Franke told his family that he was in the midst of a top-secret investigation that would detail corruption in the Oregon prison system, particularly drug trafficking. He apparently planned to name names and implicate several highly placed government officials. The district attorney believes Michael Franke to be the victim of a robbery gone wrong, but Franke's family is convinced he was assassinated. They think someone wanted Michael Franke silenced and his findings on the Oregon prison system suppressed forever.
Why haven't we heard about this?
Honey, yeah. Thank you. I was like, what? Okay, so Former prison guard Bob Merchant says, the three main criminal activities that I observed working in corrections was the introduction of drugs into the institution, falsifying of records, and theft of state property. He says, basically anything that was not nailed down was subject to be stolen.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, all of the things.
Yeah.
Or what I witnessed.
There was a constant flow of drugs being brought into the institutions. One of the most common ways was staff bringing them in their own lunch buckets because there were no searches being conducted on staff as they entered or left the facility.
What the world?
Can you believe in 1980?
I mean, I worked at the body shop and they searched me like full body cavity search when I left every day.
They probably made you use a clear bag, girl.
I mean, come on.
He says, I was told by my superiors to keep my mouth shut and mind my own business or I'd be looking for a job. Mm. A reporter for the Statesman Journal, Stephen P. Jackson, says that when Mike went in, he had a good old boy system to contend with. Quote, a lot of these guys have been here for 20 to 30 years. The system has run the way they want it to run for that. So here comes some guy from out of state who has all these high-minded ideas about what he's going to do, and it just rubbed a lot of them the wrong way. Oof. Stack tells us that Frankie had gathered what some believe to be concrete evidence that the state prison system was corrupt all the way to the top. At the end of 1988, he was conducting an intense personal investigation, and he knew it could blow up in his face at any time. Kevin Frankie says, which is his brother, says, quote, he had uncovered a lot of organized crime. He asked, you mean like the mafia? And he said, no, an organized criminal element in the system, and that he was going to do a thorough house cleaning immediately after the first year, and that his quote was, a lot of heads are going to roll, and he said it may cost him his job. Mm. Oof. Michael's sister-in-law, Katie Frankie, says she called him on January 13th, and he said he was going before the legislature and clean house the following Wednesday. She says he was very concerned, and she thinks he'd uncovered something much bigger than he expected. Stack tells us that it was 4 years later that Frankie was discovered murdered on the side porch of his office building. Police began to put together a timeline. At 6:50 p.m., the usual Tuesday staff meeting, Frankie spoke with one of his subordinates. 30 minutes later, at 7:20, two correctional employees noticed the light on in Frankie's car and the driver door was wide open. They also noticed his phone was inside the car. They looked around but couldn't find Michael, and so they paged his pager, which he had on all the time, but they got no response. So they called their superiors. Two officials arrived at 8:30 and said they conducted a, quote, meticulous search of the building, but Frankie was nowhere to be found. The two men did not call the police and left around 9:30 p.m. At 12:45 a.m., a security guard found Frankie on the side porch that had apparently been thoroughly searched 4 hours earlier. The glass on the side door was shattered. Frankie's briefcase with documents on the investigation was missing, though they don't know if he had been carrying it at the time. They just knew that it was missing.
Okay.
Stack says that police theorized that Frankie had been murdered by someone trying to rob him. They interrogated several known drug dealers and, quote, street criminals. One of them had said he had witnessed the murder and fingered a drug dealer named Frank Gable. The witness had said Gable was robbing Frankie's car when Frankie came out of the office around 7 p.m. According to this witness, Frankie approached and the two got into it over the briefcase. Frankie tried to bring the guy into the prison, which is what they're saying in the reenactment. I don't know if that's true, but he was like, you come in here.
Like, this is where you belong.
He's just going to throw him in prison. Yeah. So then the man stabs him, steals his briefcase, and flees. Apparently, then, Frankie staggered up the steps of the porch and broke the glass in an attempt to get back into his office. Frank Gable ended up being charged with Frankie's murder, but for many, the evidence doesn't add up. The amount of bruising and wounds on Frankie's body indicated to them that more than one person was involved in the struggle. Katie Frankie says she believes Frank Gable is a scapegoat and that it goes much higher up in the Oregon government. Stephen Jackson, the journalist, says the police put blinders on as to what they were inclined to believe. Senator Hill says, it seems there has been reluctance to really, really scorch the earth to find out what happened. There were other things that Frankie's friends and family felt were disturbing discrepancies in the official explanation of Michael's death. His car had a state-of-the-art alarm system, but it didn't go off when the assailant broke into the car, and there were no signs of forced entry. If the killer had stabbed Michael at the car enough to puncture his heart and lungs, why was there no blood found within 100 feet of the car? Lastly, if Frankie was killed at 7 p.m., as police estimate, why was his body nor the broken glass noticed when the building was meticulously searched between 8:30 and 9:30 p.m.? Stack tells us that many people in Oregon believe that Frankie was the victim of a premeditated murder carried out by several men and possibly investigated by high-ranking officials who feared they would be named in Frankie's investigation. One eyewitness at the scene appeared to corroborate this theory. Bob Merchant says, at 10:15 to 10:20 on January 17th, a young man riding in a car looked over where the scene of the crime was and saw 5 to 6 men running towards a Volkswagen van. Merchant says that if Frankie had been abducted and then brought back to the building where he was killed, this would fit into the abduction theory. Stack explains that in the abduction theory, on the night of his death, Frankie unlocked his own car, deactivating the alarm. Simultaneously, a group of men approached him. Frankie didn't keep any regular office hours other than the Tuesday staff meeting, so it seems the perpetrator knew his schedule. The theory is he was brought back to the office, possibly to get anything related to his investigation, which in the reenactment they say that they want computer tapes.
We'll take those, like, computer tapes, too.
Oh, that's cool. Not great writing.
The theory is that Frankie saw it was a chance to escape and ran, then was probably attacked and received a couple of his wounds, ran again, breaking the glass to get in his office, then he's apprehended by the guys, stabbed, they take his briefcase and run.
Oh, what a terrible death.
Ugh. Senator Hill says the impression is that things are being held back and stonewalled. He says again it's giving the impression that there's some type of cover-up. On the night of the murder, several had reported seeing a man in a pinstripe suit lurking around in the corrections building after hours. He had an olive complexion, was 5'10" tall, and weighed about 180 pounds. They then show a composite of the man that was made after witness statements, but the DA didn't release the drawing for 5 months, saying the quality wasn't good enough for publication.
I mean.
And I was like, has that stopped literally anyone ever before?
Oh my gosh, seriously.
We have seen so many terrible composites.
We've seen children's drawings of composites.
Yes.
People drawing with their toes.
Also, the composite had been drawn by a top police artist. So, like, fuck you guys. Stack tells us one other fact that leads to the idea of a cover-up. No paperwork detailing Frankie's investigation into the Oregon prison system has ever been found. Apparently, shortly after the death, some inmates saw about 23 bags of shredded papers coming out of Michael Frankie's office and some surrounding offices. Stephen Jackson says, that's something you have to wonder about. Who authorized shredding documents from a murder scene?
Okay.
Katie Frankie says the officials investigating Mike's murder don't want it solved because it goes much higher in the Oregon government.
All the way to the top.
Michael's brother, E. Patrick, says that their family is dedicated to bringing this to a close. Quote, we're going to find out what the hell happened, and we're going to see that the people who were involved receive their full punishment. So then they give a one-sentence update, but we'll go ahead and just fill in the rest of the story. So once in a blue moon of a Resolved Mysteries host's life, they get so lucky to find one newspaper that has covered a case for its entire life in its whole.
Yes.
And they do so many articles that at some point they release a giant timeline of events to summarize everything.
Oh my God, that's the dream!
Which is literally the job that we have to do every week. Being done for me. So finding one is gold.
Nice. Congratulations.
So I am not above reading you this timeline, telling you who wrote it, and just adding some little bits of detail along the way.
Absolutely.
We're here. We love it.
So this timeline is from the Statesman Journal, which is a Salem newspaper. It's written by Cappy Lynn from April 19th, 2019. And then I also mixed in a little bit from another timeline I found in the Willamette Week article from April 25th, 2019 by Nigel Jacquise. So May 1st, 1987, Governor Neil Goldschmidt introduces Michael Frankie, 40, as the new director of Oregon's prison system. Frankie is a lawyer, former judge, and most recently chief of corrections of New Mexico. June 1987, Oregon Senate confirms Frankie, who officially takes the helm of an agency that now answers to the governor instead of the Human Resources Department. February 1988, Frankie is in the process of cleaning house with a $28.5 million prison construction plan, a criminal population study, changes in prison management, and tougher disciplinary rules. March 1988, Goldschmidt outlines his new prison plan to add beds and hire more corrections employees. December 1988, the state prison population tops 5,000 for the first time, which Frankie reports is the second most crowded system in the country.
Whoa. Wow.
Yeah, I did not know that. I can't believe I didn't know this stuff. It is reported that state facilities are designed to house 2,856 inmates and the department budget to handle 4,447.
Wow.
January 11, 1989, the Statesman Journal reports Frankie and his department is under scrutiny by the Oregon legislature for spiraling expenses. He blames budget overruns on the costs of adding new prison space and the burgeoning inmate population. January 17, 1989, Frankie is found stabbed to death near the north entrance of the Dome buildings across from the Oregon State Hospital on Center Street Northeast. A massive investigation begins with Oregon State Police and the Marion County District Attorney's Office leading the way. May 1989, police first speak with Gable, so this is the guy towards the end of the segment that they say did this, after receiving a tip that he knew something about Frankie's murder. July 14, 1989, 5 months after the murder, the Statesman Journal reports the FBI is investigating a possible connection between official corruption and drug smuggling at the state penitentiary in Frankie's murder. Still fresh in the minds of many is a 10-month investigation into drug smuggling in 1986 that led to the prison superintendent's resignation and the firing of several corrections officers. July 1989, a Marion County special grand jury convenes to review the case. April 6, 1990, Frank Gable is indicted for the murder of Michael Frankie. He's charged with 6 counts of aggravated murder, punishable by death, and 1 count of murder, punishable by life in prison.
Ah, this poor guy.
The different counts represent different murder theories presented by prosecutors to the grand jury, from Gable killing Frankie during a car burglary to killing him in connection with Frankie's job as the state's top prison official. April 8, 1980, state police arrest Gable at the Coos County Jail for Frankie's murder. April 9, 1990, Gable is arraigned in Marion County Circuit Court before Judge Greg West. February 1991, just a few weeks after jury summons are sent, Unsolved Mysteries airs a segment suggesting Frankie was abducted by 3 men, then returned to his office and killed. The prosecutor's theory alleges Frankie was killed when he discovered Gable prowling near his car. April 18, 1991, after 6 weeks of jury selection, 9 women and 3 men are selected to decide Frank Gable's fate. It takes another week before the last of 4 alternates are in place. May 1, 1991, opening statements begin in a 2-month trial that focused on the credibility of witnesses on both sides. The defense questioned how the crime scene was processed, including waiting to investigate the body until daylight.
Okay.
June 27, 1991, a Marion County jury finds Gable guilty of aggravated murder, bringing some closure to the most expensive homicide investigation in Oregon history. July 11th, 1991, Gable is sentenced to life in prison without parole the same day he marries one of his defense attorneys, Portland lawyer Karen Steele.
Oh.
August 29th, 1991, Gable is transferred to an Idaho prison for security reasons. September 1991, the Statesman Journal reports it cost taxpayers more than $1 million to defend Gable. Oregon State Police estimates the investigation costs its agency another $1 million.
This is like propaganda. They're like spinning this against Gable. They're still, who attacks someone after you put them away? Who keeps talking? Oh, it costs so much money to defend this person. It costs us so much money to convict this person. He's already gone. He's already gone away. Like, why is his name still in your mouth?
Yeah.
What are you doing? Oh, man.
I know. April 20th, 1994, the Oregon Court of Appeals upholds Gable's conviction. It's the first of many appeals made before the appeals court and the Oregon Supreme Court, all failing. 2005, Oregonian and Portland Tribune columnist Phil Stanford writes more than 100 columns over 13 years arguing Gable's innocence.
He's such a honey.
So he's the person in the podcast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the podcast Murder in Oregon is about this. Unfortunately, I thought it was going to be an episode and it was an entire series, so I didn't get to listen to it, but Allison has.
It's amazing and everyone should listen to it.
Is he the host of it, the journalist? Oh, mm-hmm. He's just in it.
He's in it, yeah.
Yeah.
A 2005 Sunday Oregonian investigation concludes the evidence, quote, rules out all but a lone figure, the man already behind bars. 2007, Willamette Week publishes a cover story about Greg Johnson, who claims he knows Gable is innocent because he drove Frankie's real killer, another Salem meth dealer named Tim Natividad, now deceased, to the crime scene. He also claims he watched prison officials pay Natividad for the murder.
Oh my gosh.
Nell Brown, a federal public defender in Portland, takes up Gable's case. For the next 7 years, Brown's investigators methodically track down the witnesses who testified against Gable, more than a half dozen of them. They all recant their testimony.
Oof. They were all addicts. They were all in prison.
2014, Brown files a 189-page brief arguing Gable was wrongly convicted. The Federal Public Defender's Office held a brief in 2014 saying the prosecution of Gable was flawed and that about a half dozen witnesses had recanted statements directly linking Gable to Frankie's death. The Oregon Innocence Project has also filed a brief on Gable's behalf, raising questions about the case. Federal public defenders also argued that John Kraus, a Salem man who was on parole for a robbery at the time, repeatedly confessed to killing Frankie, telling numerous law enforcement officers, as well as his own mother, brother, and girlfriend, that he stabbed Frankie when he caught Kraus burglarizing his car on January
17,
1989.
Oh.
Kraus's confession, they said, matched the crime scene and autopsy evidence corroborated by eyewitness testimony and considered truthful by FBI polygrapher. The federal defenders argued that the trial court that convicted Gable improperly excluded Kraus's earlier confession to the crime. Marion County prosecutors argued that Frankie came upon Gable as Gable was breaking into the state prison system director's car. They said Gable stabbed Frankie 3 times and then fled. Frankie staggered to the porch and died. Gable's attorneys at the time pointed to a lack of physical evidence tying Gable to the killing and suggested other people could have been involved in the death. Associates of Gable offered testimony against Gable, including that they saw him drive away from the state hospital grounds around the time Frankie was stabbed, that Gable was asked to get rid of a plastic bag with unknown items inside, and that Gable alluded to doing something that would make the news. Gable's wife at the time, who worked at the state hospital, testified that Gable often carried knives. April 18, 2019, a federal judge rules Gable should either be released from prison or retried within 90 days. The court erred in excluding evidence pointing to another possible suspect in the murder, U.S. Magistrate Judge John Acosta said in his opinion and order. He also ruled Gable's defense attorneys provided ineffective counsel by failing to assert his due process rights in the face of the trial's court's error.
Mm. His defense attorney was such an alcoholic that even the prosecution went to the judge and said, this person is incapacitated by their addiction to alcohol.
Oh, no.
This man, he is unable to be properly represented by this attorney. And the judge completely ignored all of these lawyers petitioning to have this lawyer removed. This defense attorney.
Oh my God.
And he wasn't up next on the docket. He was specifically selected to represent Gable.
Oh, gross.
Yeah. So, and I think Acosta was essentially like, any lawyer should have caught this mistake.
Yes.
So one sign of the strange saga Gable's case became, Frankie's brothers, E. Patrick Frankie, 76, and Kevin Frankie, 65, issued a statement April 19, 2019, supporting the man convicted of murdering their brother. They say he didn't do it.
Wow.
Quote, we are happy in the extreme that the very real probability that Frank Gable will be released and his freedom is within sight, the brothers wrote. The state can no longer afford to manufacture a case built on lies and half-truths. Ugh. Both have been staunch defenders of Gable and believe he was wrongly convicted. Patrick Franke at the time said he simply wants to see Gable walk out of prison. Quote, if nothing ever comes of this, Michael's legacy is an innocent man was set free, said the oldest of the three brothers as he chain-smoked cigars and discussed the case on the grounds of the Oregon Department of Corrections. He firmly holds his belief that Michael Franke had uncovered corruption in the state prison system and was killed by conspirators to silence him. He remains married to the ex-girlfriend of a man he thinks was involved in the killing, who is no longer alive. Mm-hmm. So it was Natividad's ex-girlfriend that he's now married to. Quote, there's still some warm bodies out there that shouldn't be walking around, said Kevin Franke. Patrick Franke interjects, there's no way to prove it, I don't think. Kevin Franke said he believes with more time, someone will come forward with new information as long as the case remains in the spotlight. Kevin Franke received a letter from Gable written after the judge's order. He said, I'm scared to death because I've been behind bars for 30 years. Where do I get a job? How do I pay the rent? He said that scares the expletive out of him, Kevin Franke said. Gable is now being held at a prison in Kansas. This was from before, obviously. If he ever gets released, he'll likely be brought back to Oregon first. About a year ago, he married a woman who lives in Kansas and intends to return to her, his sister said. It says, skepticism dogged the case against Gable from the start. After all, no physical evidence linked Gable to the murder. Prosecutors relied heavily on the testimony of ex-cons and drug addicts. To many, the idea that Oregon's corrections chief could be the casualty of an ordinary car burglary seemed too simple to be true. To Kevin Franke, things didn't add up. In 1990, he ditched his life in Florida, packed his Chevrolet Caprice, and headed to Salem to investigate. Wow. Franke, now 51, sank into the city's underworld.
He also left because his car was shot at, his tires were slashed. There were notes left on his house. One said, welcome to Oregon, now go the fuck home.
Oh, my God.
My God.
From the first night he was there, he was actively harassed.
Ugh. Some other stuff that I thought was worth noting. At the time of his death, the 42-year-old Franke was a troubled man. His second marriage was unraveling. Shortly before the murder, his wife, Bingta, had left, taking their young son. Child support and tuition from Frankie's earlier marriage, plus his own spending habits, had stretched their finances. They had to borrow from family and Frankie's coworkers to pay for ordinary expenses. At work, Franke absorbed crushing pressure. Memos and correspondence from Goldschmidt's archives show that Franke was often out of step with the governor's agenda. He alienated lawmakers by making spending decisions without their okay. Though Franke loved the public spotlight, he seemed to have a tin ear for politics. Lawmakers trusted by Goldschmidt quietly complained, and he feared Franke was becoming a liability. A month before the murder, Goldschmidt sent his prison's chief a scathing two-page memo. Quote, there's no room for more speeches about we don't have a crime problem or prisons won't help, Goldschmidt wrote. Blasting Frankie's management style, he added, this is more of a warning than anything else. I don't want every issue or decision to be dumped on me. In the weeks before his death, Franke was on the phone regularly with Goldschmidt's office as he was prepared for an upcoming presentation to lawmakers. Quote, corrections told to watch budget was the top story on a copy of the Salem Statesman Journal found in his car. The typical tenure for corrections administrators was short, and Franke was looking ahead. On January 3, 1989, he had fired off his resume to a New Mexico firm, according to a review of his computer files. He planned to be in Oregon only one more year. To hear Kevin Franke tell it, Michael Franke was looking over his shoulder. He slept with a loaded .45 under his pillow. He talked about surrounding himself with people he could trust. So this was from when Gable was released. It says, Gable 59 is scheduled to be released from the Lansing Correctional Facility in Kansas at 10 a.m. Friday. Today, Frank Gable was ordered released by the Honorable John V. Acosta after nearly 30 years in prison for a crime he did not commit, said Assistant Federal Public Defender Nell Brown in a statement. Gable thanked his attorneys for investigating his case in depth, for believing in his innocence, and pursuing justice over the course of the last decade. Quote, there were many hard days on this long journey, Brown said. According to the order, he will be placed under strict supervision and will be unable to leave Kansas or Missouri without the court's permission. In Acosta's order for release, he did not impose computer monitoring. Quote, the court is reasonably assured the defendant will appear as directed and not pose a danger to the community or any other person, the order read. Acosta issued a stay on the court's previous ruling to release Gable within 90 days. The judgment is stayed pending the resolution of the DOJ's appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and, if applicable, the U.S. Supreme Court. And apparently he was, like, on the phone with one of the Frankie brothers, like, as he was leaving prison.
Yeah.
Like, telling them about it.
In one of the episodes, everyone is crying. It's the last one when he finally gets out.
And I tried to find Gable because they had said that his wife was in Texas and he would want to go back to Texas. But it looks to me like he's still in Salem. So,
I mean, he was only released in 2019, so it's surprising that he could be anywhere else.
I know.
I felt bad for him because the woman that he was in Texas, and then everything else he knows is still based in Oregon. His family's in Florida, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Crazy story, right? You were just saying, Carlin, we never know what we're going to get. And
yeah, like, I knew there were drug problems and prison problems, but I didn't know it was like that.
And then Unsolved Mystery shows up in 1991. And how many years later? 20 years later.
It's wild. Well, yeah, and UM's update was like, Gable's been arrested. Cool.
Yeah.
Like,
we got him. It's like, actually, simmer.
Yeah.
Simmer.
No. Not good.
Not good, Oregon.
Great job.
Bad job, Oregon.
Bad job, Oregon. Great job, Carlin.
Oh, yes.
Thanks, thanks.
Okay. Segment begins. Sack tells us that when Odette Gordon was 8 years old, he was diagnosed with a minor learning disability. At age 12, he began to withdraw from his friends. By the time he was 18, Oded was totally withdrawn and, quote, unwilling to communicate with anyone. I have to say that the way they talk about Oded is pretty on the level throughout this segment, but I think unwilling is troublesome because if he has autism or if he's dealing with something, it's not a matter of willingness.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So Razee Goldstein, Oded's mother, says that Oded was afraid of the responsibility of growing up because he didn't have the emotional wherewithal. He was too anxious. He was too afraid. And he couldn't do things on his own. I'm sorry. I hate all of that.
Yeah. We hate it.
The responsibility of growing up. He's not Peter Pan. He's someone dealing with the ramifications of autism.
Yeah.
Stack says a year later, Oded was diagnosed with as having autism. Stack then describes autism as a neurological disorder that affects physical, social, and language skills. He says there is no known cure for the affliction, and doctors had little hope that Oded would ever return from his dark and silent world. Oded's mother enrolled him in a facility in Greenfield, New Hampshire, where young people with mental and emotional disabilities participate in work therapy and receive counseling. Oded seemed to respond to his new environment and even began communicating with the staff worker. Sheila Bay Harvey, Oded's teacher at the facility, is interviewed, and she says that when Oded came, he spoke very little, but then staff would hear him speak occasionally, and he could say things when prompted and encouraged. Mm-hmm. I later read Oded was nonverbal, but sometimes would exclaim things.
Mm-hmm.
Like statements of what actions he was taking or how he was feeling, but it wasn't conversational at all. So Stack says approximately 6 weeks after having arrived at the farm, the students were outside doing their chores and somehow Oded managed to wander away from the group.
Oh no.
An hour later, he was nowhere to be found. Carl Driggers, the former police chief of Greenfield, New Hampshire, says that search dogs were brought in. Stack says that the search dogs followed Oded's scent for approximately 3 miles. Along a stretch of Highway 31, the scent abruptly vanished. Authorities believe that Oded may have been picked up by a passing motorist. Carl Driggers says that his feelings are that Oded will be found. He says he's out there, and he's out there among the population, wherever it may be, but he's definitely out there. Stack says that there have been several repeated sightings of Oded, the most recent in last January. So Oded went missing in 1989, and this was released in February of 1991. So I don't know. Last January is somewhere in between there. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it feel like we've been in 1991 of airings for like the last two seasons?
Yeah.
Mm.
Like, every time one of my segments is like, this case first aired January 1991. It feels like that every time.
Well, and I think, too, maybe because of the Film Rice edit we were talking about before, I don't know how these originally ran, so.
For the most part, it's not super, super different from what I can tell.
Okay.
There's like an episode here or there that was bumped way over for whatever reason, but for the most part, they're this similar to how they were.
Yeah, that's true.
Razee Goldstein then makes a plea to Oded and says, Oded, I would really like to hear from you. If you can, I hope that you'll call. And then she gets choked up and she asks him to call her or his grandmother or his uncles. Ugh. She says that he doesn't have to tell anyone where he is. They just want to know he's okay. Shaq then gives physical stats. Oded is 5'8", has black hair, brown eyes. At the time of his disappearance, Oded was 21 years old. Authorities suspect that he may have hitchhiked out of the area and could be anywhere in the United States. So here's my research. Oded was never found. Mm. Oded Gordon was recognized as learning disabled at age 9, but continued to attend a public school until age 16. He earned good grades at school, particularly in mathematics, and won prizes for his scholarship in various languages, even though he couldn't speak them due to his disabilities. So he could write them and read them.
Oh, wow.
But he couldn't speak them. Mm-hmm. However, he was bullied by other students. And as he got older, his performance deteriorated to a point where he eventually had to withdraw from school. Lear's Foundation Plowshare Farm is where Oded was living for 6 weeks prior to his disappearance. And the staff stated that while he was there, in just that short amount of time, he had made great progress. Mm-hmm. The Doe Network gives a bit more insight into Oded's mental and physical challenges. He was autistic and had great difficulty communicating with others as a result. He often talks to himself, and on the rare occasions when he speaks to others, it's usually in a low tone of voice with intervals of silence or in short bursts. Mm. He is not considered dangerous to other people. He has the functioning of a 7-year-old and cannot care for himself. Mm. In addition to having autism, Gordon is also anemic. Even the slightest injury could have been a big injury for him. Mm-hmm. Previously, before coming to the facility, Oded hadn't spoken in 3 years.
Oh my goodness.
Like I said, Oded was living at the Lyris Foundation Plowshare Farm. Their mission statement is, Plowshare Farm is a community where people with a wide range of abilities and capabilities live and work together to create a genuinely inclusive neighborhood of the broader community, forging opportunities for every member of the community to reach their full potential. The last time he was seen there was May 12th, 1989. From what Sheila Bay Harvey said, she was his teacher. He also lived with her and her husband and her 5 children. So she was very close with him. She wasn't a teacher. They lived together. Mm-hmm. And Bay Harvey said that Gordon was apparently bothered by flies. And that day, it was like the first warm day of May, so the black flies were out. And if you have ever lived or spent time on the East Coast, black flies are a nightmare.
So gross. And I hate it.
I am 100% with Oded and would leave too. He said he was going to sit in a barn or, I also read, a car. Mm. But he didn't. I guess he apparently just wandered off. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a coat, identification, or any money with him at the time of his disappearance. Mm. When he left, Oded was in the middle of an evaluation period to determine if he might move into the school or might become apprenticed with a local craftsman. That was part of the program of the school, was that they worked with local craftsmen and autistic people would come and work and be trained in a skill. Mm-hmm. Hmm. I read that all missing person cases are difficult, but when you're looking for someone who is autistic, it becomes much more complicated because their behavior isn't the same as ours necessarily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Trooper Kathy Ferrand of the state police said he may be sleeping all day and walking at night. It's hard to predict what he may or may not do. Mm. If a police car came by looking for him, he would probably walk away.
Like, he could even be hiding just because he's scared or something.
Yeah.
So there was another theory that he could be just in the woods, yeah. but unable mm-hmm. to find his way back mm-hmm. home.
Yep.
There were some sightings. So police received a report from a man who said he had picked up a hitchhiker matching Gordon's description and dropped him off in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, about midnight the same day. Since then, searchers have concentrated on the area between Fitchburg and Temple. The last report that people feel like was a definite sighting occurred in that area. The search was extensive. Volunteers, oh gosh, they traveled daily between Fitchburg and where Gordon's school was to look for Gordon. An office opened in the city to help run a search. There were offices in Greenfield, Peterborough. Everybody was coordinating these efforts. Everybody was working really hard to find him because the farm was doing such great work. They even asked local people in Greenfield to go shopping in Fitchburg so that maybe while they were on the streets, they would spot him. Mm. Police officers in these small towns were sending people to Fitchburg to shop and be on the street in case they spotted him in the woods or hiding.
Ugh, yeah. Oh my gosh.
Gordon was described as a gentle, wonderful person. And the luncheonette where he was last seen, he was on the intersection of Route 13 and Route 2 in Fitchburg. And Sheila Bay said that she believes that Gordon, who also has dyslexia, could be mistaking the number 13 for 31. Mm. And he's familiar with Route 31 because it's by her home. Mm. The man who picked him up claimed that he was in the truck with him for 25 minutes. Police theorized that he must have gotten a good look at him. And then the man didn't report anything until he saw Odette's picture in the paper the next day. Ugh. And then a woman said that she had been driving past a man resembling Odette and that she rolled her window down and he took off in the woods. Mm. You know, police theorized at the time that the sightings are 90% because, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with that area, but there's not a lot of people. It's not like a city where everybody matches that description yeah. and everyone's on the lookout.
It seems kind of wild to me that he would have managed to hitchhike, though.
I don't know.
You know, with being so nonverbal, it just seems like I just have a hard time. If you can't communicate, this is where I want to go, what is someone going to do for you?
Well, and you would think if they picked him up and realized he was very limited verbally, that they would take him somewhere to get him help, not drop him off.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or very least the police station.
Or if you're sort of a dick, you pick him up, you yeah. think he's acting weird, mm. and then you dump him off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if he went to some area he didn't know, there's no way anyone's going to find him.
Yeah.
So, Sheila Bay, she says she was disappointed with the producer's lack of concern for accuracy.
Huh.
The way it was portrayed in the reenactment is not exactly the way it happened. For starters, there was snow on the ground when they filmed the reenactment, but Odette disappeared in May. Mm-hmm. Also, the producer showed no interest in the likely reason for Odette's disappearance, they said. Gordon was anemic. He tired easily. He had been working on the farm with the bays all day, and she thinks he might have just gone into the woods.
Yeah.
She was disappointed. She felt like they just want to portray a dramatic departure, but she doesn't think that it was that dramatic. Like you're saying, she didn't think he even made it that far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's it. What a, a heartbreaker.
That's so sad. Terrible.
Yeah. So any information, if anybody has any, which I can't imagine, but New Hampshire State Police, 978-745-8908. And that's it.
Mm. That is weird. Things to share, things to feel. Carlin, do you want to go first?
Yeah, you never go.
Well, I mean, mine's not super exciting. I just finally did listen to the UM podcast.
Oh.
The Unsolved Mysteries podcast.
Oh, yeah.
I've listened to all of them so far, and I do like it. As we discussed, I think, like, having the first episode be a ghostie was an interesting choice because I almost gave up on it, too. Not that it was bad, but I was just like, eh.
But it does cover some interesting cases. I think the interviews are good. I get really jarred by the host every time he busts in because his voice is just like too much. And he's not Robert Stack, so.
Yeah, I think they're going for like a Robert Stack, like male baritone host.
Yeah, but we don't need it, especially on this. We don't need it.
It's definitely stories that we haven't heard before, yeah. Which is really cool.
Yeah, I like it so far.
Eliza?
Well, the last episode, we shouted out two Wondery podcasts, and I have another one. I don't know if anyone ever watched the show, or I think it was a documentary film before, Catfish on MTV.
Oh. I never watched that.
Catfish is a show on MTV that I only ever watched in like 2012 or 13 when I would visit the certain friends that we knew that had cable. Otherwise, mm-hmm. like no one I knew had cable. I did not have cable.
Yeah.
So when we'd go there, we'd watch like Catfish and other crazy shows that like just seemed so luxurious to have access to, which is so silly now. Catfish is now a podcast on Wondery, and they've just taken the audio from the shows and put it into a podcast episode, which is honestly perfect for me because I really don't watch TV. Like, yeah. During the day, there's no way I would sit down to watch a show ever.
Yeah.
Ever. So I can still get the same TV sensation, but listening to a podcast. And you know how those shows are just so comforting because they're always laid out the exact same way?
Yes.
You know everything.
Yeah.
This is what they're going to do. Now they're going to call the person. Now they're going to look it up. So anyway, Catfish, the podcast, so good. It's like really moving, and he's not exploitative of these people. He's really empathetic and tries to show them like you're being duped, or tries to help the person who's catfishing them to be like, you, this is not right, and what are the things deep down inside of you that are causing you to pretend to be someone else. And it's really good. So if people haven't started it yet, I really have listened to them all now, but the episode that came out February 24th of this year, and the names are Mathan with an M and Leah, that would be a good one to start with. It's really, there's twists and turns in all of them, but it's great. I think people will love.
So is it like, it's just pulled straight from the MTV thing?
Yeah. And then Neve now goes over the audio and will sometimes explain. So we drove in the car and the breeze was this, and we're wearing a blue shirt, whatever. Like he's trying to make it, but you can hear that background noise of like the car driving. It really sounds like you're listening to a TV but not watching it.
Yeah.
But it works. Like, you could totally picture everything. And he's a good, like, explainer of what when things need to be explained. Like, he will try to interject with what the people looked like so you can kind of picture them and
fill in the visual elements.
It's good.
Cool.
I also have a podcast. So have you guys listened to This Is Actually Happening?
Yes.
It pops up all the time, but I've never listened
to it. So I feel like that to me is like radio rental, right? Where basically I don't even know the name of the host.
Right.
It is just someone telling their story. It's a first person account. There's no speculation, no narration, and then the show just ends. The description of the show is true stories of life-changing events told by the people who live them. But sometimes they are not life-changing. Sometimes they're like pretty low-key events that are a little weird or a little strange and you just want to know more about.
Yeah.
Cool.
Love. All right. So next episode, I have...
Oh, Eliza! You have Edgar Casey, that person that the listener wrote to us about.
Yep, that's me. That's my segment.
Okay, my segment is the unexplained death of Crystal Spencer.
Okay, and then the wanted segment of Dennis Dupree.
If you want to support us, and we appreciate everyone that does, and even if you can't support us monetarily, we appreciate you listening so much. But if you're interested, you can go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast and subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher. If you do, you'll get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast and on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us and explore our website at resolvedmysteriespodcast.com and our email, resolvedmysteriespodcast@gmail.com, along with, if you like to send things that we can hold in our little grubbies, P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon 97293. Please send us your stories for listener short stack episodes so we can keep making them. You can send us anything you want to. We love to hear from you. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, leave a 5-star review and tell a friend. For every review we receive, we donate $1 to an organization. And this month, by leaving us a review, you can help out the organization Angels with Misplaced Wings. And we love you, and we'll be in your ear holes again soon. Goodbye.
Bye.
Carlin, that time Carlin seemed way after me.
Oh yeah. See, to me that one was pretty close on all.
Ooh, I love the finger pointing.
All seeing.
It doesn't matter because that's why we do it. It's great.
I just don't understand why it doesn't matter. I don't understand the science of it.
You clap, and then I clap. I still line it up, and we're still talking at the same time.
Yeah.
All right.
It's just like a general marker.
I'll show you
for her
one day when you're older.
Thanks, mommy.
You're welcome. All right, for the love of God, this is the last segment of season 3.
Speak fast.
Okay, so the final segment is a missing persons case, and it's the case of Oded Gordon. Les's got a tin can in her hand. She's ready to go.
My Hoya plant is really dry, and I had to water it.
Jesus.
It's just like,
that's like the least thing I thought you were gonna say.
It's dry. Okay. But you know, a Hoya, it will last forever, so it's usually fine.
Yeah,
but sometimes well, it's a good thing you chose to water it right now.
You know, though, don't worry, it wasn't urgent, and you get yourself a Hoya, it'll last forever. Mm-hmm. I do need to make noise during hour 9 of recording.